ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Is a new intelligent design-based engineering paradigm of biology emerging? I'm Casey Luskin with ID, the Future, and today we have on the show with us Dr. Brian Miller, Research Coordinator for the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute. Dr. Miller holds a bachelor's degree in physics with a minor in engineering from MIT and a PhD in physics from Duke University. He's a very accomplished speaker on the topic of intelligent design, having spoken worldwide, and he helps to manage the ID 3.0 research program at Discovery Institute. He's also been a primary organizer of Discovery's engineering research group and the Conference on Engineering in the Life Sciences, which is part of our ID 3.0 research program. He's contributed to multiple books on this topic, most recently the book Science and Faith in Dialogue, published by the South African publisher AOSIS, in a chapter titled Engineering Principles Explain Biological Systems Better Than Evolutionary Theory. So, Dr. Miller, thank you so much for coming on the show with us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Well, we're here today to discuss your new chapter in this book, Science and Faith in Dialogue, which again is titled Engineering Principles Explain Biological Systems Better Than Evolutionary Theory. And I'm really excited to talk about this with you because you have been developing this argument now for quite some time that there's a new design-based paradigm for biology that uses engineering to interpret biological systems. And you start off your chapter by reviewing some of the history of the design debate. So I'd like to start this interview off by asking, is the intelligent design concept something new? Like, you know, we often hear it's an invention of Christian fundamentalists in the 20th century. Or is it a very old idea that goes back deep into human intellectual history?
Yeah, that's a really fascinating story because this debate actually goes all the way back to about 500 BC. Some of the most famous philosophers of that time period debated these very same questions. So you have people like Democritus, who was an atomist, and he believed that you could explain everything in nature as these eternal atoms that you couldn't see, and that they would interact according to certain rules, and chance, time, and those rules would explain everything we see in life, from rocks to philosophers who thought about rocks. And he was in a debate between people like Plato and Aristotle. And there are people that believe that there was design in nature. They believe that there was a mind, and that mind envisioned patterns. They called them forms. And then the matter was shaped according to those forms to see the things we have today, like life. So they believe that mind was first and mind shaped matter. And of course, Aristotle and Plato thought about that in very different ways, but they both would be proponents of design.
Yeah, I think this history of design thinking throughout the ages, it's surprising just how many of the most prominent philosophers who Western civilization respects, Plato, Aristotle, etc., they were essentially proponents of a version of intelligent design.
That's absolutely true. In fact, one side note I need to mention is that people have tried to argue that Aristotle was actually in conflict over this particular point. And that is completely untrue. There's a lot of modern philosophers who are experts on this, and they've corrected this error because Aristotle believed in design, just like Plato, but Aristotle saw the design as almost like a soul, or what he called as a male principle inside of organisms, which shape matter to produce adult forms, like an acorn into a tree. He did not believe that the matter in itself could do that, but he believed that an immaterial agent would shape matter according to a form or a blueprint to produce life. So he also believed in design, despite what some people have said recently.
Very interesting. So, of course, in the recent last couple centuries, there has been a shift in this debate where I think that the more elite segments of society have shifted towards a more materialistic view of origins rather than a design-based view. Of course, it was the advent of Darwinian theory that really cast doubt upon intelligent design in the sciences, but presently some developments in science over the last few decades have begun to cast doubt on neo-Darwinism. So can you share a few of those that you highlight in your book chapter for us?
Certainly. And just to give a few terms for those that might be new to this podcast, is Darwinian evolution is simply the basic idea that you've got variation, you've got different environmental conditions, and some subpopulations will outsurvive others, what's often termed survival of the fittest or natural selection. The term neo-Darwinism is simply Darwinism plus genetics and population genetics. During the Enlightenment, the evolutionary narrative, the Darwinian story, became essentially a sacred creation narrative. So it wasn't just a scientific theory, but it was essentially the foundation of their thought about the world. Now, what's happened is over the last several decades in particular, the evidence has moved very strongly away from the early predictions of evolution. So, for instance, the fossil record does not show a nice tree where organisms slowly evolve over time and change dramatically, but you have anything radically new appear suddenly, and after it appears, it doesn't change significantly. So that's often referred to by people like Stephen Jay Gould as punctuated equilibrium and stasis. Now, people talk about what are called transitional fossils, things like Archaeopteryx, Tiktaalik, the whale series. What's important to realize is the term transitional fossil does not mean true transition. It's not a fossil where you have an ancestor, a descendant, which is a transition, and the descendant of that, which is another ancestor, in a clear linear progression. Transition simply means two fossils that share similar features, in the same way a toaster oven has features of a toaster and an oven. But those quote-unquote transitions also appear suddenly and then do not change. So the fossil record shows that things only evolve in very small ways. In addition, what we'll talk about later is the fact that evolution predicts that the similarities you see in species should fit along a very consistent tree-like pattern. Things that are supposed to be more closely related should be similar in every way. And that has proven to be not the case. But you often see dramatic differences in creatures that are believed to be very closely related and remarkable similarities in creatures that are very distantly related. In addition, you have what's called the waiting times problem. And that was really pushed forward by people like Günter Beckley, Ann Gager, Ole Hofsesser. And what they've realized is that when you do a very rigorous mathematical analysis of how long it takes for new mutations, very specific and coordinated mutations, to enter a population and spread through the population is a really, really long time. And they weren't the first. There was people like Doreen Schmidt who wrote about this in like 2008. For instance, if you look at a human population or the ancestors of humans, the time it takes for two specific coordinated mutations to appear in a population is like over 100 million years. So the time available for these major transitions in the fossil record is far, far, far too short for even the smallest amount of the new genetic information required for those changes to appear and spread through the population. Another problem is that when you look at mutational studies, what you find is all mutations which alter the basic architecture of an organism, mutations that would operate early in development, are harmful if they are expressed and do anything significant. So what you find is this is a great paradox that people have talked about for decades, that the genetic variation you see in any species only is allowing for small-scale changes and not large-scale changes. So all these problems, when you bring them together, create an enormous challenge to the neo-Darwinian framework or the standard evolutionary model. And this was highlighted at the famous conference in London by the Royal Society, New Trends in Evolutionary Biology, where leaders in the field acknowledged that the standard evolutionary model, neo-Darwinism, the modern synthesis, cannot explain large-scale changes. It can only explain small-scale changes. And at that meeting, people presented all alternatives that could expand their theory, and there is not one piece of evidence that was produced that any alternative extension, like phenotypic plasticity or niche construction, could do anything significant that could explain these large-scale transformations. So the theory is in a very difficult place.
So you argue, Dr. Miller, that not only is neo-Darwinism falling into question, but that there are reasons to explore a return of teleology to the sciences. And you say, quote, part and parcel with the erosion of the reductionist assumption has been the implicit acceptance of the assumption that teleology is central to life. So how do you see biologists assuming that teleology is central to life? And do you see them sort of putting up some resistance to this assumption in the way that they talk about biology?
Well, what's fascinating is if you go back even many decades, even if you go back early 1900s, biologists intuitively recognize that you have to assume design in life to understand it and to study it. But they resisted that idea strongly because they were materialists, they were scientific materialists. They believed there was no teleology. And teleology is just a fancy word for design or purpose. But they believe there was no teleology in nature. So they assumed that it really wasn't there. In fact, there was a famous quote by a physiologist named Ernst Wilhelm Ritter von Bruch, who stated, quote, teleology is a lady without whom no biologist can live, yet he is ashamed to show himself with her in public. Now, the difference today, though, is that people are talking about teleology explicitly. There's a wonderful book put out by MIT Press, which deals with systems engineering, and it's called Systems Modeling in Cellular Biology. It came out in the early 2000s. And they basically say that to understand biology, you have to look at the purpose, and they use words like purpose and design for these systems. So teleology is now becoming much more explicit in the language because they just simply cannot avoid it.
That's really fascinating. I think that this is obviously a good sign that teleology is being talked about more and more. What about the concept of optimality? You provide quotes from various sources predicting that biology is sort of like these poorly cobbled together clued structures that are far from optimal. But do you think this assumption holds water, and is it bearing good fruit as we try to understand how biology works?
Well, what's really amazing is in biology, particularly systems biology, engineers are working with biologists at a much, much greater level. In addition, biologists have been able to really understand what's happening in these systems in much greater detail. And those two advancements in the field have caused the evolutionary assumptions, the assumptions driven by materialism, the anti-teleological assumptions, to change. So more and more biologists, particularly systems biologists, are using design-based assumptions, tools, models, and language. And this optimality is really significant, because evolution predicts at both an abstract level and a more of a deep theoretical level that life should often be suboptimal and non-functional. And there's a beautiful paper put out by David Snoke in the journal Complexity that really lays this out in detail in a model. And the reason for that is, if you want to innovate, if you want to increase in complexity, you've got to give space in the genome for experimentation. So you've got to have duplicated genes that are allowed just to exist and be non-functional as they randomly mutate until something useful occurs. Or you've got to allow different proteins to interact and cobble together in different ways, even if it's non-functional, until something interesting appears. So the suboptimality and non-functionality is a very clear prediction of the theory. Yet, the more biologists study different systems or structures, particularly with the help of engineers, what they find is what they initially thought was suboptimal or poorly designed or non-functional, they now know is optimally and exquisitely designed. Classic examples would be our vertebrate eyes. People thought the fact that the photoreceptors faced backwards was a bad design. It was just a remnant of our evolutionary past. But now they realize it has to do that, because it has to interact with epithelium cells to basically remove burnt out discs and to exchange materials and basically to regenerate. People said the ACL in our knee is badly designed because it tends to break. But people like Stuart Burgess, who is one of the leading engineers in UK, has talked about how that's a perfect engineering design, because engineers often design certain things to fail first, like the bumper in your car, because the bumper is expendable while the passenger section is not. In fact, ACLs really don't tear all that much more than bones like tibias break. So that's again shown to be optimally designed. The laryngeal nerve is this nerve that has this curvature and seems a little bit longer than it should be, naively. But engineers have shown that that is a very good design, because that nerve allows other nerves to carry along its trajectory to reach other systems in the body. So again, that's a good design. I could talk more about the panda's thumb and countless other examples where people thought design was poor at first, but then they realized it was optimal. In fact, if you read people like Beilig at Princeton and other leaders in the field, they talk about how if they predict optimality, that helps them to do better research, because that prediction typically comes true if they understand the system. It almost always comes true as science develops. In fact, what they found is that many systems operate close to the maximum efficiency possible by the physics and the chemistry. So again, optimality is being recognized more and more as a powerful tool of prediction in biology. Oh, the best example, though, is junk DNA. Because if you go back to the 1980s, people thought 97% of human DNA was non-functional junk, because that's the natural predictions I talked about. But the ENCODE project found that almost everything they thought was non-functional, they now know is functional. Like, they went up to like 80% pretty quickly. And every year, more and more examples of what they thought was non-functional, they find is serving a clear purpose. In fact, there was a biochemist named Dan Grauer who said, if ENCODE is right, evolution must be wrong, because there's no way that much should be functional if the evolutionary framework is accurate.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Dr. Miller. Most of these examples of suboptimality or non-functionality tend to evaporate upon closer inspection. And the more we look at biology, we realize that this sort of Darwinian evolutionary prediction that life is full of poorly functional structures is really not holding up very well. So you go on to write, evolutionary theory predicts that biology should resemble human engineering only marginally at best. Perhaps we might say along the lines of clunky Rube Goldberg machines. Do you think that this prediction holds up, that evolutionary biology resembles human engineering only marginally at best?
Yeah, this whole idea of a Rube Goldberg machine is really significant, because evolution predicts that you've got lots of structures that form, like proteins, for instance, and they do something. But then what happens occasionally is they come together randomly to produce something new, like the ATP synthase or bacterial flagellum. But the proteins were not initially designed to work in something like the flagellum, but they just kind of came together by chance. So it's almost like a Rube Goldberg machine. And Rube Goldberg was a cartoonist and engineer who would create these really elaborate contraptions, like this device that would wipe your face. Like it'd have a napkin that would wipe your face. But it was composed of like a parrot, a clock, a spoon, and several other items that were not designed to fit together. And the humor was that these systems were incredibly clumsy, they were ridiculously inefficient and overly complex. And that's what life should look like if evolution were true. But as I mentioned in that book, The System Modeling and Cellular Biology, they have some beautiful quotes in the book, how they're saying a much better way to see life is through engineering frameworks, because it really looks like top-down design, where it looks like a mind planned the large scale features in advance. Like you plan a car, you know, it has to have a passenger section, a transmission, an engine, and then each component of each of those systems was perfectly engineered to work at an optimal level with the entire whole in mind. So everything was put together with the whole in mind. And that's the sort of patterns you see in life.
So Dr. Miller, let's close out this first podcast about your paper by talking about the bacterial flagellum and an engineering analysis that was performed by an engineer named Waldian Schultz. You write in your paper, the number of essential components, interrelationships, requirements, and constraints in the flagellum proves that the system must have originated at once through the act of an intelligent agent. This sounds far more elegant than the Rube Goldberg type kludgy engineering that you're talking about. So can you flesh this out a little bit for us?
Yeah, and Dean Schultz did such a beautiful work on that set of three papers on this, because what he did is he said to himself, if I were going to design a propulsion system, a rotary propulsion system in a bacteria, so it's nanotechnology, how would I do it? So he envisioned, what are the major components or systems you would need? You would need, obviously, an assembly system. You would need a propulsion system. You would need a navigation system, a repair system, and so forth. And then he started to think about, what are the constraints? What's the design logic? And then he, with the help of biologists, looked at the details of the biology. So his imagination of the system was sort of a top-down analysis. Looking at the biology was a bottom-up analysis. He was looking at the lowest level in the hierarchy of the actual proteins. And then in his third paper, he showed how those two analyses fit together beautifully. Like he was able to anticipate many aspects of the system, because any propulsion system, a rotary propulsion system, must fit within tight design constraints. And it's really beautiful, because even if you look at something like the navigation system, if you don't have a navigation system, the flagellum is completely useless, because it's just not going to turn on and turn off at the right time. It's going to likely cause more harm than good, because it'll waste resources. But this navigation system has to perfectly integrate with every other system to operate properly. So it's a perfect example of top-down design, the opposite of a Rube Goldberg machine, because everything had to be planned in advance, fit together perfectly with the right interrelationships, and meet multiple constraints. In fact, Dean Schultz identified like 80 constraints on the proteins in terms of if they fit tightly together, loosely together, they fit temporarily, or they didn't connect at all. And what happens is, if you look at, let's say, Michael Behe's idea of irreducible complexity, that was really beautiful work. But the challenges that he identified pale in comparison to what we now know is true about the flagellum. Because what you see is a top-down design logic where it's an irreducible set of systems. And those systems represent an irreducible set of subsystems. And those subsystems represent an irreducibly complex set of components like proteins. And they must fit together through foresight, coordination, goal direction, and meet multiple tight constraints at once, or it's completely useless. So one, it's very clear the system couldn't come about by things like co-option or incremental complexity increase. And two, you see such clear evidence of a mind, of design, of planning, that to deny it, one has to practically come close to deliberately suppressing the truth.
Yeah, you know, when I see these Rube Goldberg machines, Dr. Miller, I think that even they require foresight and planning. I mean, it's not easy to get all those parts to come together and work, but what we see in biology, like the bacterial flagellum, is far, far more advanced than a Rube Goldberg type contraption. The parts are fit together quite elegantly in a coordinated manner, as you said. And I think that this is definitely a different view of biology than what we hear from the evolutionary side sometimes.
Very well said.
Okay, well, thank you, Dr. Miller, for this first podcast about your paper, Engineering Principles Explain Biological Systems Better Than Evolutionary Theory. Will you stay along with us for a second podcast on this?
Yes, I'd be happy to.
Okay, well, that's great. We'll continue the conversation with Dr. Brian Miller about whether engineering or evolutionary biology better explains what we see in living systems. I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.